Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's session of Personal Theology, which is a program sponsored by the Unitarian Universalist Church of Berkeley for over 40 years. We appreciate your attendance today. Before I introduce our speaker, I want to read the UUCB Land Acknowledgement Statement. As we begin, we want to acknowledge that this church occupies land in Hu Chin, the unceded territory of the Chenyo-speaking Ohlone people. We understand that we continue to benefit from the seizure and occupation of this land. We acknowledge and embrace our responsibility to take restorative action. We affirm that this is deeply felt and commit our congregation to be in right relationship with Indigenous communities, aligning in solidarity, supporting Indigenous projects, and caring properly for the land. Today's speaker is Reverend Jay Atkinson, and he is a retired UU minister with 32 years of experience. But I think it's interesting, and I think it's important that y'all know that before that, for 11 years, he was a nuclear physicist and then made the big midlife jump to becoming a minister. And I personally really admire that and appreciate the courage to follow through on that move. He did study at Meadville Lombard, and he has been adjunct professors at various universities, including Meadville Lombard, excuse me. So I'm going to turn it over to Reverend Jay Atkinson. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Anne. I'm going to turn on my screen share, and I'll be doing that, using that a lot during the during my presentation. Trying once again to say who we are. We Unitarian Universalists, as I'm sure you know, have a reputation, deserved or not, for getting somewhat tongue-tied whenever we're asked to explain what Unitarian Universalism is all about, trying to say who it is that we are. A few years back, maybe you remember that elevator speeches were all the rage, and we were all being urged to come up with half-minute explanations, the amount of time that it would take for an elevator ride up or down to explain to a fellow traveler just who Unitarian Universalists were, or what we were all about. And for many of us, a better option often has been to fall back onto the so-called seven principles. Most of you know about those seven principles, even if you wouldn't be able to recite them verbally. So let me remind you of, what they are. I think most of you will recognize these. These are part of the UUA bylaws, in particular Article 2 of the bylaws. But this is not all that's in Article 2 of the bylaws. Article 2 goes on to contain a list of sources, which I expect is something that you're also familiar with. The living tradition which we share draws from many sources: direct experience of mystery and wonder, words and deeds of prophetic people, wisdom from the world religions, Jewish and Christian teachings, humanist teachings, spiritual teachings. And these have existed in Article 2 of the UUA bylaws for about, 35 years. They were adopted in 1985. But just to show you the overall context, here is the entire text of Article 2 as it currently stands. We have the statement of the seven principles, the six sources, and then we have these additional three paragraphs, which let me enlarge for you. An article about, or a paragraph about purposes, a paragraph about inclusion, which is a relatively more recent addition. I don't remember exactly when, but sometime in the last 20 years. And then a very old standard freedom of belief on the universalist side of our tradition, something like this paragraph goes back to the early 1800s, 1803, in fact. The universalists passed a statement which they called the Winchester Profession, because it happened in Winchester, New Hampshire, and it contained what was called the Liberty Clause. And that Liberty Clause is the direct ancestor of this clause. So there are the three additional add-on here. And this is the entire statement then of the current Article 2. So let me go back to the principles. These pretty much exist as they have for about 35 years. And they've often come in for some criticism. One of the complaints is they're not very poetic. If you think about what words you might want to have read to you on your deathbed, probably these would not pop into your head. Not as readily maybe as the 23rd Psalm or something more traditionally comforted. These are not, for better or worse, exactly words of comfort. And people have complained about that. They would like our principles to have some linguistic beauty about them, shall we say. Another complaint that has been rendered against them is that they're unhelpfully broad. There are all kinds of people who would agree to these seven principles. Certainly many mainstream Christians and Jews, at least Reformed Jews or Restoration Jews, maybe even liberal Muslims or Hindus, Buddhists, lots of people. These are kind of broad and, in their own way, bland. They don't pin down Unitarian Universalism very specifically. And so people have thought that we needed to say more to really fully come up with a statement that articulates who it is that we are. Now, there have been attempts to do that. And let me show you just a couple of them. I'm going to skip that for the moment. This is a statement that was written back in 1887, or maybe it was 1886. I may have the date off by 1 year. Written by William Channing Gannett, who was a Unitarian minister. This comes from the Unitarian side of our tradition. And this came at a time of, we might say, schism within the Unitarian movement. There were people who were very devoted to the idea that Unitarianism was still a Christian organization, and others who wanted to be free of the Christian label. And this was Gannett's attempt to say what it was that Unitarians of that time, believed. And I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but you can kind of get the feeling. Love the good and live the good, reason and conscience, honoring the Bible, and all inspiring scripture. So it's an attempt to broaden things a little bit. Revering Jesus and all holy souls. So it's an attempt, you see, to kind of spread out from Christianity. The growing nobility of humanity, we would say now. We believe that good and evil carry their own recompense. We believe to join hands. This was the social gospel era, or the beginning of the social gospel era. Self-forgetting, rejection of the ego, loyal life awakes in man the sense of union with things eternal. We worship one in all, that life whence suns and stars derive their orbit. So a reference to cosmic evolution and the natural world that we come out of, and a reference to the love with which our souls commune. So this was a major state. It was never incorporated into any official statement, but it was very popularly read from pulpits and referred to. More recently, about 12 years ago, or maybe 15, 20 years ago, there was this statement by David Rankin, that was actually printed as a little wallet-sized card by the UUA. Some of you might remember having that. It was red, and you could open it up, and these 10 statements were included. And it was an attempt to expand a little bit on the seven principles as they then stood. But it went a little further in its language and expanded. I mean, you can see some of the traditional ideas like tolerance of religious ideas, freedom of religious expression, worth and dignity of each human being, and the force of love, and so forth. So I'm not going to dwell on that. I just wanted you to be aware that, and once again, this never had any official adoption into the bylaws. It was just put out there as an optional statement. And even more recently, there was a statement by David Bumbaugh, a minister from our Universalist side of our tradition. And this is interesting because it has much more a flavor of cosmic evolution. Living things, members of a single community. Let's see, the earth and all who live upon the earth are products of the same process that swirled the galaxies into being. It has that flavor of cosmic evolution. So I won't go through that again either. I just want to illustrate some of the attempts. But by far, the most talked about attempt to tweak or improve on the seven principles is one that started about, and those of you who have been active in the eighth principle movement can correct me if I'm wrong, but this began to be talked about a lot, I think maybe 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago. And what it does is propose to add to the existing seven principles, an eighth principle, so that the new text would read, "We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote first the seven other principles as they now exist, and journeying towards spiritual wholeness by working to," I need to minimize my screen here so I can read this, "to build a diverse and multicultural beloved community by our actions that accountably dismantle racism and other oppressions in ourselves and our institutions." So that is an addition to the existing seven principles that actually has been adopted by many UU congregations around the country. It is being proposed for formal adoption, I think, this summer at our General Assembly, if I'm not mistaken. And so that is the latest way in which people have tried to modify the existing seven principles. Now, let me switch to a slightly different piece of my presentation. Where do the seven principles as they currently stand come from? To talk about that, I'm going to switch from my PowerPoint to another document. This is written by the Reverend Richard Trudeau, and I'm just going to refer to pieces of it. This is a statement from the American Unitarian Association in 1959, just before the merger with the Universalists, and it's fairly brief and kind of legalistic. "In accordance with this charter, the AUA shall be devoted to moral, religious, educational, and charitable purposes, and shall diffuse the knowledge and promote the interests of religion, which Jesus taught as love to God and love to man." So a small reference there to our Christian background. Strengthen the churches and fellowships. Organize new churches and fellowships for the extension of Unitarianism in our own countries and other lands. And encourage sympathy and cooperation, kind of bland again. And this was the precursor from which the principles that we adopted in 1961 emerged. And those, I'm gonna move down here to, he has a lot of commentary about this, but I'm gonna skip over this. This is kind of interesting. This is the Universalist Declaration of Faith that was made in 1935 and revised in 1953. So this is where the Universalists were coming from just before the merger. God is all eternal, as eternal and all conquering love, spiritual leadership of Jesus. Spirit is a supreme worth of every human personality. That's the origin of the first current principle. The authority of truth known or to be known, that's kind of related to a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. The power of men of goodwill, again, pre-gender language, and a liberty clause, neither this or any other statement, so forth. So that's a little bit of the background of where our current principles came from. Now, one of the things that you may not be aware of, and I'm gonna stop this one and share something else now. One of the things that you may not be aware of is that our current bylaws require actually that Article 2, which contains the principles and the sources, be studied for revision at intervals of every 15 years. That's a requirement, a built-in requirement. An attempt was made, a study was undertaken back in, I'm thinking it began in around 2006 or 2007, and the study commission brought their recommendations for revising Article 2 to the General Assembly in, I think, 2009. And so I want to show you proposed revision of Article 2. Is that visible now?
Yes.
Okay, this is the proposal that the study commission brought for revising. It was originally brought in January of 2009. It required a two-year process. And in 2009, the General Assembly, by a majority vote of more than 50%, accepted the proposal. And then, as the bylaws require, it had to be ratified the next year in 2010 by a two-thirds vote. So the proposal was never adopted. I was at that General Assembly. I think it was very close. It may have gotten something like a 65%, but it fell short of two-thirds. And as you can see, it's rather different than the current Article 2. It starts out with a statement of purpose. It reverses the order of things. It starts out with a reference to sources, true religious heritage grounded on thousands of years of Jewish and Christian teachings, the Unitarian heritage, affirms that we need not think alike to love alike and that God is one. The Universalist heritage has preached not hell, but hope and courage and the kindness and the love of God. Contemporary UUs have reaped the benefits of a legacy, prophetic words and deeds. And then it goes on to say about no single book or creed. And then it comes to the principles and proposes something that is very much like what they are now. Not much different. A few words tweaked here and there, but mostly the same. And like I say, it was adopted by a majority vote in 2009, but failed the necessary two-thirds vote in 2010. So it's a historical document at this point. It was never implemented. And go on to my next document, which is another study commission has been appointed because of the failure of the first one 12 years ago, required that we begin the process again. So a new study commission was appointed and began its work in around 2018. And this, of course, is happening after the blow up that we had in 2017 with white supremacy and the recognition that the UUA and its hiring practices had been unknowingly, as some people would say, bound up with white supremacy in its preferential hiring practices and in a number of other ways. And so the Board of Trustees of the UUA created a new study commission for Article 2. And this is the charge that they gave. And this is worth looking at it in some detail because it is it's rather long. And I think we need to highlight some things. Proposed changes should articulate core UU theological values, whatever those may be. The board believes that one core theological value widely shared among UUs is love. The Commission on Appraisal, in its report, Engaging Theological Diversity, well, I'll not dwell on that too much. Instrumental value and mature love is a terminal value. And Cornel West famously has said that justice is what love looks like in purpose. Our commitment to personal, institutional, and cultural change, rooted in anti-oppression, anti-racism, and multiculturalism, values and practices, is love in action and should be centered in any revision of Article 2. So this is the Board of Trustees' instructions to the Article 2 revision or study commission. It goes on to say that it should be guide us in the transformation of ourselves, and I'll skip over those details. And then we have this highlighted area. We therefore charge this commission to root its work in love as a principal guide in its work, attending particularly to the ways that we and our root traditions have understood and articulated love and how we have acted out of love. So you remember that in the existing seven principles, the word love does not occur anywhere. Anywhere. It's just not there. And a great deal has happened since then, obviously. Love has emerged as a central focal point in our self-consciousness. So this is a very contemporary kind of charge to the commission. It goes on, the commission is instructed to include in its considerations and deliberations the clear call for the inclusion of another principle, the eighth principle, which we talked about earlier. We specifically direct the committee's attention to the 2010 proposals, the ones that failed back in almost 12 years ago now. And then it goes on to say the commission is charged with reviewing all sections of Article 2 and is free to revise, replace, or restructure them as needed to meet the objectives stated above. There is nothing sacred about the number of principles or sources, nor their specific wordings, nor in the way that Article 2 is laid out. We encourage creativity. They're throwing the process pretty much wide open. They call that for it to be inspirational, memorable, and poetic. The language should be inclusive and welcoming, explicitly anti-racist. Article 2, it must be remembered, are broad statements of principle, not detailed or programmatic implementation goals or plans. So, and it goes on with a few more details, but those are the main things that I want to call your attention to. Okay. One of the things that has bedeviled, if that's not too much a negatively theological word, is whether the principles should be enduring principles that we can find present in our entire history, we can say, yes, these are the same principles that Unitarians and Universalists were following in the 19th century and the 18th century, and even way back in Poland and Transylvania in the 16th century, whether we should look for things that are that have that degree of enduringness, or whether they should be more topical and contemporary. And people are line up on both sides of that question. Some of you will remember a famous sermon preached by Theodore Parker back in 1841. He titled it The Transient and Permanent in Christianity. And this was at a time when transcendentalism was coming to the fore within Unitarian circles. And Parker was very much in the transcendentalist mode of thinking. And when he talked about transient and permanent in Christianity, what he found to be transient was what most conservative Unitarians of that time thought was permanent. And so he was roundly criticized, in fact, excluded from the ministerial association by many of his colleagues for this statement. But he denied the miracles that Jesus had been said to have performed. He denied that Jesus was a supernatural being. And this was too much for the kind of Christianity that many Unitarians understood themselves to be giving their allegiance to at that time. But he raised the question of transient and permanence. And I've talked a little about what happened since then in the 19th and in the 20th century. So let me skip up to Earl Morse Wilbur in his History of Unitarianism, published in 1945. Wilbur, of course, was the first president of Starr King. He was its president for almost 40 years. He wrote The Definitive History of Unitarianism, a research project that occupied him for 40 years. And he said that Unitarianism across 400 years has been characterized by three leading principles: freedom, reason, and tolerance. That was his statement of what had been enduring in Unitarian history. Those statements, that triad, freedom, reason, and tolerance, have fallen into somewhat of disfavor nowadays, I would say, but they're still remembered by a lot of people and lifted up by a lot of people as still the best statement of what we have always been about. But as you saw in the charge to the commission, now we're hearing that love is really even more basic than those three principles. And although love is obviously very general and can be understood by individual people in many different ways, it is also very basic, and it has a fair chance to be identified as something that has always been present in our traditions, even though maybe not explicitly named, but kind of as a background. So the questions stand: should our new Article 2, whatever it turns out to be, focus on what's most pressing right now, as the eighth principle people would like us to believe? Should it focus more on a few broader principles that have been truly enduring over two, three, four centuries of our history, of our religious tradition? Obviously, the language of the eighth principle, in fact, all the language of anti-racism, I think we could fairly say has been around within our tradition for mostly just the last 70 years. I mean, there were anti-racist statements that you can find back in the Universalist side of our tradition. Benjamin Rush, back in the 1780s, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, called for a universalist vision in which all of the races would be accepted on an equal footing and that no discrimination would exist. But certainly the language of white supremacy is modern language, even though it's been present as an operative force for four centuries and longer. So what is the balance between historically enduring principles and currently pressing issues? Will we end up with a list of principles again, or something else, a covenant, a list of values maybe, something that sounds more like a mission statement than a list of principles? Well, those are the questions that we have to look forward to. Incidentally, the study commission is going to be bringing its proposed draft out in January, just 2 months from now. So we'll all get to see what they will come up with without too much more waiting. But for now, I think I have finished what I would like to do for my presentation with maybe too many words and too many densely worded slides for you to read through, and invite your responses, your questions, your ideas, and your discussion. So let's talk about some of these things.
As they say, Reverend Jay, let's have at it.
Have at it.
Now, we've been blessed, those of you who've come in, with Connie Rule, and I think it's Neil. What was Neil's last name?
Weinberg.
Yes, and Neil Weinberg, who
I can raise my hand.
Oh, wonderful. Yes. Have been on this, working on this, from what we heard in before we got started, working on the revision. I think there's.
No, you've been working on the eighth principle, I think, right?
In Olympia.
Just the eighth principle. Okay.
We have a study group that is working on how we might present to our congregation in a way that allows everyone's opinions and feelings to come forth, and then to come at some point to a vote whether our congregation will adopt the eighth principle or not.
And am I correct in saying that the proposal that the entire UUA adopted is coming up at this summer's General Assembly? Is that right?
My understanding is that it'll be addressed again, but that the vote doesn't come up until 2023 or 24.
And by that time, the commission to revise the entirety of Article 2 will also be making its proposal. So it may be something of a moot point by then.
Exactly.
Depending on what they come up with.
Yeah. All right. For hand raising, have down on the bottom of your Zoom, there's a button for many of you called reactions. And in there, there's something called raise hand. That'll make it easier. We have a lot of people here today, and it'll be easier to see who has questions instead of trying to see who's waving on the screen. So if you have some questions, would you do the raise hand? This is Reverend Jay, this is so intriguing. And someone asked, will these slides, I'll get Reverend Jay's documents and have them up on our website with the replay of this so that you'll be able to see that. If you don't have reactions down there, what did they say? It's in participants and the three little dots will have raise hand. If you don't have a reactions button, it should be click on participants, and then there's three little dots, and that should also give you a raised hand option. All right, we have David Lingenfelter will go first, then we have Cordell, then we have Dwight, and then we have Bill Brown. And then please, folks, line up and continue to ask questions. So, David.
Oh, thanks, Lonnie. And thank you very much, Jay. A terrific presentation and an incredible amount of UUA history looking at the organization and asking who are we? And that kind of introspection in a corporation seems like a remarkable phenomenon in itself. How would you compare our degree of introspection and wish to identify ourselves to other organizations like ourselves that are involved in charitable purposes. It seems we're head and shoulders above.
Your use of the word introspection makes me think of the notion of free inquiry, because one of the enduring affirmations in both the Unitarian and Universalist side of our tradition has been an emphasis on the right of people to freely inquire into, I mean, early on, it was an inquiry into the interpretation of the Bible. And free inquiry was understood in that context. And in more modern, in the 20th century, the free inquiry became obviously much broader. But the notion of free inquiry and being self-critical, which is what I understand by your word introspection, has always been part of actually Protestantism in general. James Luther Adams, the great theologian and social ethicist of the 20th century Unitarian side of our movement, said that that free inquiry was the essence of the Protestant principle, to be self-critical. And so so the idea of questioning existing things and becoming ever broader has been central to our development. In fact, I think you could say that there's always been an internal tension within both Unitarianism and Universalism. As people became step by step more free thinking, they began to push the theological envelope outward. And the bulk of the lay people and ministers had to decide, is this gone too far? Is this beyond the pale? Or are we going to draw the circle larger in order to include this vanguard of new thinking? And with a few exceptions, the decision has always been made to draw the circle larger and to be more inclusive and include a broader range of ideas and beliefs and values. It's not to say it's a complete free-for-all, but I mean, we have been accused wrongly of saying that Unitarians and Universalists can believe anything they want to. That goes too far. There are some horrible beliefs that we would not accept among us. But by and large, we've always moved in the direction of expanding the circle. Like that poem says, how does it go? Now I'm blanking out. Love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that took him in. That's the second two lines. I forgot. I'm not thinking of the first two lines. So I don't know if that answers your question, David, or not.
It's fine. Thank you very much, Jay.
All right. Thank you, David. Cordell, you're up next.
Thank you. Thank you, Jay, for your, I guess, gathering this perspective for us and giving us a chance to look at it. I have the one question that was in my mind as you were talking, and I'm not a historian of UUism. I mean, I'm getting immersed, but I would not claim to have a sense of the history. But my question is, we're looping through some process. Periodically, we're doing something. And what's curious to me is that there's something at our core that is either trying to articulate who we are, or is responding to our aspirational nature to incorporate what we may be becoming as we learn in our journey. Mm-hmm. But each time we stop and describe who we are, I'm like, who is it that's trying to now express who they are? There's still some fundamental thing that is like, okay, I'm now talking about how I want to be seen at this moment, but underneath it, there's something there that is the source of that pursuit. And so that to me speaks to maybe more the identity of who we are that is somehow always underneath this articulation process. Right. But I'd love to know what you think about that.
Well, you know, that's kind of what Theodore Parker was getting at in his famous sermon. When he talked about the transient and the permanent in Christianity, as he was speaking back in 1841, he seemed to be saying that there was a core of underlying fundamental unchanging things that gets clothed differently in each era, and it has different trappings, so to speak. And what we need to do is be sure we understand which are the trappings and what is the core. That was the essence of what he was trying to say. And I think it's partly at what is at issue here. What is the core? What is the historically enduring identity of Unitarian Universalism, and what is merely its current manifestation that wasn't true 70 years ago and won't be true 70 years from now. And maybe the list of principles, or however we articulate our identity, should include bits of both. It should have a core statement, and it should have a statement of what is most pressing for us to do now based on that core identity. And I think that's what the eighth principle is trying to say, that based on some kind of core identity, which we have a hard time putting into words, this anti-racist, anti-oppressive, multicultural mission in 2021 is what that core of values now calls us to put front and center. That's how I understand what the eighth principle is all about. Now, I'd like to mention, I hope this is not too much of a tangent, but Rebecca Parker, whose name many of you know, offered a sermon almost 20 years ago now that suggested that maybe we've been mistaken in always looking for a center or a core. Maybe we should think of our movement, our Unitarian Universalist identity, as a single cell, like an amoeba, with a membrane, and indeed a semi-permeable membrane. And what defines us, literally from the Latin word definire, is what the limits are, not what's at the center, but what's on the boundary, what we would absolutely never let in through the cell wall, and what is so important that we would never let out. But the focus should be on what the edges are, rather than what's at the center. That's a very different way of looking at it, but one I think worth giving some thought to.
I have one follow-up idea, and then I'll give it up. Sure. But one thing that occurs to me, using a metaphor, is that the idea of home, where do we live? Where is it that we always come back to? And the idea of visitation, we go on journeys and we have visitations. Mm-hmm. And so we're gonna expose ourselves. And then sometimes we'll, in the visitation, find something and then bring it back home, and it becomes something that we keep at home. And so my journey fell into that kind of metaphor. I'm gonna let someone else ask a question.
Yeah, that triggers something I'd like to mention. One of the things that has characterized our tradition of free inquiry is that we're always willing to change and to grow. So we're willing to take in new things and recognize when we have been in error, or whether our vision has had too many blinders on. And that's part of the whole free inquiry thing. I had another thought that's escaped me, so I'll let the questions go on. Maybe it'll come back.
All right. Thank you, Cordell. Thank you, Reverend Jay. Reverend Bill Brown.
What about Black Bill?
I don't know when I became a reverend, but okay.
I'm pushing you towards ministry, babes.
Okay. Well, Andrew is the one you got to push, but I think she'll do it. So I need to preface this just a little bit. I have only been a part of this community for 4 years, so I am seeing things as a new member. Why is change so difficult? When I first talked to Reverend Michelle, when she came here, we talked about the eighth principle. I'm like, yeah, let's do this. Let's have a discussion. Let's get it to a vote. Boom, we could be done in like a month or two. And she's like, oh, no, Bill, this is going to take 2 to 3 years. Like, we have to do all these things. And I'm like, anti-racism, anti-oppression. There's no question. How do we just make this happen? And it's like, no, it doesn't work that way. What is it? Is it fragility? Is it stubbornness? Why does it take so long to implement change?
I suppose one could answer that psychologically, institutionally. Let me think what other, maybe some other ways I'm not thinking of. Institutionally, we're saddled with a parliamentary process for making these kinds of changes. And that has its own inertia built in. Another point is that, and I don't know how many of you I would be speaking to when I say this, but a lot of people, for a lot of Unitarian Universalists, the seven principles as they have stood more or less unchanged for the last 35 years have almost a sacred quality. And things that are sacred are changed with caution. Anytime anyone proposes a change to any of the seven principles, there are some questions you have to ask. What's wrong with the statement as it exists? Is the proposed change a faithful change? And if it is or isn't, faithful to what? What's the standard, to use Cordell's word, what's the core, the faith, what's the core that we ought to be faithful to as we think about some change? The seven principles don't articulate what core they are trying to be faithful to. That's left sort of under the radar, we might say. So there is that sense of sacredness, and some people have objected to the seven principles because they seem to be treated by a lot of people almost like a creed, even though we don't recite them in worship very often. In fact, I don't remember ever reciting the seven principles in a worship service. We recite covenants. We recite our own covenant every Sunday at worship. And it is, I would dare say, somewhat more poetic than the seven principles, but it has its prosaic elements too. So change comes slowly when people revere existing words. I don't know what else to say.
You know, Jay, I'm going to jump in. Dwight, forgive me, and Karen, jump in on Bill's point. Because the Unitarian Universalists have been the one group that has gone after, you know, racist and oppressive, you know, we've walked with Martin, we started the ACLU, we started the Red Cross, you know, it's like, we are that. Mm-hmm. And so the eighth principle, you know, it seems so obvious. And I happen to be in one of those groups that the eighth principle, you know, is talking about. It's like, what? You're already doing this. What? You know, why are you taking 3 years? What? So I'm with Bill on this, but your answer is helping me, you know, a little bit.
I might mention in that context that some people have said that we ought not to put the words of the eighth principle in the principles as an eighth add-on, but do something to give it more prominence, because it sounds, in their argument at least, more like a mission statement, a kind of a marching order, a charge, and not so much a principle. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know how that sits with people, but it does have that quality of an urgent mission. I mean, we get that tonality all through UU circles. This is what we need to be centering. This is the most imperative work that we need to be doing. And a lot of people agree with that. And some of them, at least, are saying it's more than just one more principle among seven. It needs to stand out even more prominently than just an eighth principle.
All right, thank you. I'm gonna, Dwight, you're up.
Well, thank you, Jay. It's been a very informative talk. You illustrated a lot of points. I guess part of my being a Unitarian is I don't believe in creeds. I don't feel that I can put everything in words. I go to worship service to feel something beyond what I can see by reason. We talk about truth and justice, but I know I can't know the whole truth of anything. If I don't know what's true, I don't know what's just. I'm a scientist, or a retired scientist. I'm passionately believe in science and inquiry and truth, but I know I can never reach that final absolute understanding. So a lot of the words sort of grate in me, talk about good and evil. I don't believe in evil. I believe in good. Some things are very good. Some are super good. Some things have almost no good at all in them. But don't get me wrong, in the absence of good, a lot of bad things can happen. But I simply don't believe in evil. And it grates on me when I see words like this. So it's difficult to put these principles in words. I believe in the divine. Love is certainly an aspect of the divine. But it's very difficult for me to come up with a list of principles that I think are satisfying and describe me and my Unitarian beliefs.
Well, I think you're really getting at something that's related to what David Lingenfelder said. Our ability to put into words what we feel most deeply convicted about will always be imperfect, and we recognize that it will always be imperfect because words are imperfect. They come out of one half of our brains, right? And I think that's the reason why we have always adhered so fiercely to the idea of free inquiry and being self-critical. And it's also why we put into our bylaws a requirement that the purposes and principles and or Article 2, let's say, be revisited every 15 years, because as one of our hymn texts says, new occasions teach new duties. Revelation is not sealed. We see things differently now than we did even 5 years ago. I mean, that we our UUA history in the last 5 years has taught us that. We are vastly different in our senses of priorities right now than we were 5 years ago. I mean, you're right, Dwight, to be suspicious of words, and you're in good company with that suspicion. I grew up as a scientist myself, and I know very well that science is always incomplete and imperfect. The most important result of any scientific experiment is for it to go wrong. I mean, for it to prove something wrong that was formerly believed, because then you see what has gone wrong and you reformulate your theory, or you come up with a new hypothesis that is more encompassing than what you had before, just like Einstein did with Newton. So I agree completely with you. I think I value a little more highly than I heard you valuing that the attempt to put things into words still is a valuable exercise, because it forces us to sharpen our thinking And it forces us to look at places where we may have gone wrong in our earlier thinking. And that's the value of working to shape words that embody as accurately as we are able to embody what we most deeply feel loyal and committed to.
That's beautiful. We're going to go on to Karen. Karen, can you unmute?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Reverend Jay. I was really struck by, I think it was the person who wrote in 1945, the first bullet was about direct experience. And the direct experience bullet was included direct experience of wonder and mystery, as I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm struck that, you know, back in the beginning of both Unitarians and Universalists, God and Jesus were very important. And God was the source of love. God was love. And so one didn't have to talk about love. Love was God, and that was the source of love. And it kind of got lost as reason became lifted up. Freedom, reason, and tolerance, right? I'm very moved that love has become central to the charge now. I think it's vital. And part of the reason I think it's vital is this thing about direct experience that was in the 1945 one. And what Dwight has just said, that there is something beyond reason that is so important. And we may not feel, all of us, comfortable in calling it God. I do feel comfortable in calling it that. But the direct experience of things that can't be formulated into words, that are not reasonable, but that are a source of that are source things and that move us to do, to have love become action, to the source of wanting things to be just, you know, the source of good. So I think that charge personally is crucial. And I agree with whoever it is that feels that having anti-racism be the eighth principle is not sufficient, that it should permeate everything that we do, that the love that imbibes anti-oppression should be who we are, you know, and that it comes out of a direct experience of what is right and good. And I know words can't do it, but I think that direct experience of some, I like the universalist cosmic idea of a universe that's balanced and that's oriented towards some kind of merciful, just equity, you know, ecology. I really liked his first bullet, though. I thought that was getting to a quality in UUs that we could think more about, that our direct experience propels us to create a more just world that needs us to revisit our principles. So yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, I think it might be possible to make a case that love always has been at the core of Unitarian and Universalist identity. I mean, early on it was, and by early on, I mean way back in the 16th century, it was biblically based. I mean, right. The Bible was, but our earliest, what I'll call proto-Unitarian people in Poland, the Polish Brethren, took the Sermon on the Mount literally as a prescription for social ethics, how people should be in relationship to one another. And if you take from Cornel West, the statement that justice is what love looks like in the public square,
right,
then you have an interpretation of what love looked like in that long ago time, 450 years ago. Now, it's obviously not always been to the fore. Yeah. Those rich Unitarians in the 1840s whose livelihoods depended on cheap cotton were not exercising love in any way that we can very easily understand these days. And I think you'd have a tough time kind of tweezing or trying to read love into any of that. It just, to my mind, it's not there to be found. But nevertheless, thank you for lifting that up. Direct experience is obviously nowadays much more important than the biblical text as it was for previous generations. Kathy, I see your hand is up, but Lonnie is not.
Yeah, I was getting some feedback. I don't know if it's Cordell and I or you and Ariel. So I was had
sent. Oh, in the chat, you mean?
Yeah, I had sent Anne a message. So Kathy, you go ahead, dear.
Oh, thanks so much, Lonnie, dear, and thank you, Reverend Jay. I really appreciate everything that you did pose, and it really puts me in touch with what's really going on with the latest bits of history. When I'm doing laundry, I listen to podcasts such as the history of oligarchy and how we have beaten back oligarchy two other times in history. The first time was slavery when the cotton gin was invented. The larger plantations were able to afford it. So that was one of the impetus for this Civil War. I didn't realize that Arlington Cemetery used to be the plantation of Robert E. Lee. He's actually one of the biggest plantation owners. So that's the first time. The second time was in the 20s, where the bankers are doing basically what a lot of the stock buybacks are seeing today. So we're facing it for the third time. And we are pretty much at a knife edge. My question to you, because I love how you bring out and you highlight that statement about how Cornel West says justice is love in public. Because right now it seems like, and I do believe, okay, maybe not necessarily evil, but greed and selfishness and money power is becoming more and more smart. Because the anniversary of the Japanese internment, there was San Mateo Public Library that had a lot of the still living survivors tell their story. And it made me just amazed at how less visible. We're bombing seven Muslim countries. We've killed 1 million people, you know, and this was starting with Obama. And the Japanese, and realizing we're actually interning the people at the border, but we don't hear about it. And we're paying our tax dollars, $750 a night per person per bed, for not even the basic. So they're less visible because why? They're not our neighbors anymore. They don't speak English. They're invisible. So yes, it's great that we have all these covenants of wanting love, but we also need to be way, way more vigilant in not being blind to how much less visible injustice is becoming. You don't hear about any of this in mainstream news. And maybe it's my Berkeley roots, but I do see, remember that sticker saying, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. You know, how do we even start to, I mean, and that's what makes me so thankful of the UU group with the social justice group. But it's, you know, is there anything, my question to you is there anything we could do beyond just these discussions? Maybe that is the beginning. It's these discussions so that they don't become invisible. So I'll leave it to you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you're right in a sense that sitting around talking about these principles is kind of like rearranging the decks on the the chairs on the Titanic deck. I mean, it's obsession with words and with intellectual stuff and not being out on the street where action needs to be happening. I mean, at least that's what I'm hearing, part of what I'm hearing you say. And I acknowledge that what I've talked about this morning has not addressed at all the question of how do we get ourselves out on the street and do the work that needs to be done. We're doing a lot of stuff internally. How transformative it will turn out to be, I don't think we see yet. We're still very much at a talking stage, and And there's a time for talking, but there's a time to stop talking and turn things into action. That's not a very satisfactory response, Kathy. And I don't know what else to say, except I appreciate your emphasis on getting out and doing the work. And how we do that is, and we are, as a relatively small religious movement, just a small part of what has to happen socially in our country and around the world to make real change happen. The young people in Glasgow this week are out there raising their voices in the ways that voices need to be raised.
Oh, thank you, Reverend Jay. Kathy, we're going to go on to Christine because we're getting short on time and I want to get Christine in and then we can cycle back. Go ahead, Christine.
I was thinking of related to the fact that you were speaking about how much work that we have as society, that God is love. So if you come to a place where you feel like doing harm or killing something, go to God and remember that your life is going to include more than you expected, but that you don't want to take something from someone else, like their life. And that the work is that it's the power of groups. Thinking back, that some of the very nicest people, there's a power of a group, did something that if they were alive today, they might not agree with. So just as a group agreeing that something should go a certain way is a step in the right direction as far as work.
Thank you, Christine.
You're welcome.
So good to hear from you. So Reverend Jay, it's almost like that's, jumping out there and doing the action, which, I'm an action person, and understanding and having that group with the same laser focus is also very powerful when we show up as a group with our yellow shirts. And when we stand up, it is a powerful act to see that there are people. I remember Reverend Greg Ward said, and I've some of my friends here remember this too, that he said, one day I want to see, UUCB, the California Senate should one day when they hear that the UUs are coming up say, oh shit, the UUs are here. And the whole congregation fell out laughing, and he got really serious and he pointed his finger. He said, that's the problem, that you just laughed, that you are so powerless that you think that that's funny, that you could show up in that kind of mass and have that kind of effect.
Well, the group solidarity is a double-edged sword. Several people in the chat I notice have raised questions about direct experience of what, and what the Catholic Church would call a discernment of spirits is important here, because if your theology has room for both a God and a devil, you have to be able to determine whose voice it is you're hearing, and that's direct experience. And the safety valve has always been, for in our Unitarian Universalist tradition, is being a part of a community that can help you discern those spirits and understand, help you meld what you experience directly with what others experience, so as to be a force together for good. But you have the example of the lone wolf who says, God told me to climb up on the top of the Texas campus tower and start opening up. And as long as it's just one person, well, one person can do a lot of damage. But when people hear that kind of voice, like they did on January 6th, from Proud Boys and from white supremacists, and gather into a mob. I mean, Hillary Clinton's campaign slogan was "Stronger Together," but it works both ways. Mm-hmm. And you've got to be careful of what kind of group discernment is operating, because it can be terribly destructive, and it can be a hugely important force for good. And knowing which is oftentimes not easy.
Cornell, can you give me a minute? I guess Connie Rule from Olympia. Connie, did you want to say anything or ask a question? I don't know if Connie wants to. I guess not. So I just wanted to make sure that Connie didn't have a question, or Neil. All right, Cornell.
While we're talking about experience, I put a note in the chat just about my response. It was a reaction to what Dwight was saying about not really believing in evil. And I think that's a privilege of a sheltered life. There are many of us who know what evil is, who have been the direct recipients of evil acts and behavior, to the point of death for some people. And so I think we have to understand that loving implies empathy, implies connecting, and the willingness to be vulnerable and to feel the pain of another, because in the pain of another is the motivation to do something. And so to the extent that we are anesthetized by not looking, not paying attention to suffering, we are protecting ourselves, and yet we're not doing the good. So we have to take the courage to reach across into painful places and go, if we do it for a little bit, we can fix it. But if we protect ourselves, we're going to allow on our watch enormous evil to take place. So my experience, my question is, direct experience also means understanding that there are other experiences that we need to be aware of and connect to. And so, yes, the experience of the ineffable, absolutely. We need the refreshment. We need the aspirational energy, but we also need to have the motivations of knowing why we are doing what we're doing. Why am I doing this? Because I must. And where does that come from?
I think it'll be very interesting when we start to really put that word love, that charge that Reverend Jay read, the charge. Who's this? Camille? I don't see it. So anyhow, that'll be very interesting, Cornell, to see how love is put in there, because that's at the basis of empathy.
Black Camille folks, has her hand raised, but she didn't figure out how to do it electronically. So.
Okay, absolutely. All right. So Camille, can you?
Yes. What I wanted to say was that I too don't understand Dwight's comment, and we'll have to have him explain more about what there being no evil. And I don't see a way to raise my hand electronically. Thank you, Jay, for recognizing me.
Yes, I'm in a little bit of a quandary because we're at 10:46, Okay, so Dwight, do you feel like jumping on just for a minute to address your words about the absence of good?
Or evil, that is.
Well, no, the absence of good.
Okay.
Bad things happen in the absence of good. But I don't believe in a duality between good and evil. Okay. You know, we have to figure out what we should be doing. We have to reject the bad. But to think of things in terms of the devil made me do it versus, I was following what Jesus told me to do, I think that's a wrong way to look at things. And I certainly appreciate that there's a great deal of what you might call evil, I call bad, going on in the world. We've got millions of people dying in wars, and the United States is certainly bombing a lot. And I don't like that. You know, I fight against it. But to think in terms, well, that's just what the devil's doing, I think sort of absolves us from doing what we must do to stop it.
Well, you know, this should be the topic of a whole other personal theology session, good and evil, because I hear what Dwight is saying. I agree with Cordell that there's more to say about evil than simply the privation of good, which is one of the classical ways of understanding evil. I think there's more to it than that, although I certainly don't believe in a personal devil, but the ego comes close to being an individual representation of that, and it's a manifestation of the classical philosophical problem of the many and the one and the tensions that exist between those two. So that's all I have time to say.
Well, I'm sorry that we have to end this. This has been really helpful because I frankly wasn't even aware that we were considering an eighth principle until you proposed it as a topic. And so I appreciate your review of the history and the flow of how we have gotten to where we are now. And the question and answer sessions, as usual, are always amazing and allows me to appreciate once again what a wonderful denomination that we are, as you use, but also our local UUCB church, that we have so much talent, wisdom, and diversity just in our own group. So thank you all.
Indeed.
And our next session will be November 21st, and it's going to be Wendy Knox Carr. So that information will be on the website the week ahead and is in the Beacon on the Hill. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much. Thank you, our guests. Thank you, Connie. Thank you, Neil.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Good luck with your work, Connie, up there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Principal. All right. Bye-bye.